If you're hearing this, it means that you're subscribed to the public podcast feed and only getting part of the conversation. If you'd like to listen to the full episode and gain exclusive access to the first 100 episode archive, consider becoming part of the pack over at patreon.com/howlinthewilderness. Welcome to the Howl in the Wilderness podcast. I'm your host, Brian James. Howl in the Wilderness features deep and insightful conversations with renegade artists, philosophers, psychologists, and spiritual teachers who are working on the edge of dominant culture to recover and revive soul in people and the planet. On this episode, I speak with artist and scholar Mary Antonia Wood about her book, The Archetypal Artist, Reimagining Creativity and the Call to Create. Mary has been a visual artist for over 30 years, working in a variety of media. Her work has been featured in numerous solo and group exhibitions and has been collected by both public institutions and individuals. She is currently chair of the Depth Psychology and Creativity Program at Pacifica Graduate Institute and the owner of Talisman Creative Mentoring, a practice that supports artists and creators of all types. This was a really lovely conversation where we go deep into all aspects of what it means to be a creative being, the influence that Joseph Campbell, Carl Jung, and James Hillman have had on her work, and the parallels between the shamanic archetype and the artist. Some of my favorite topics. As usual, this episode is made possible through the generous support of the Howl in the Wilderness Patreon community. If you'd like to enjoy early release of full ad-free episodes and access the archive of the first 100 episodes of the podcast, please consider becoming part of the pack over at patreon.com/howlinthewilderness. Thanks for listening. Enjoy. Mary Antonia Wood, thanks so much for joining me on the podcast.
Hi, Brian. I'm so glad to be here. I've been looking forward to this. And also, I must tell you, also kind of dreading a little bit.
Ooh, say more.
Yeah. I wonder how many people say that when they
nobody says
start
it.
Out. Okay. maybe I shouldn't have, but here.
Nobody's that honest.
Well, yeah, the honest part is that I know we're going to be talking about creativity today, perhaps the parallels between shamanic sensibility and the life path of artists and creators. And there's a lot that has to do with diminishing the ego, with allowing a kind of ego death, of taking risks with that, to open yourself up to whatever forces want to collaborate with you. But I think a podcast or an interview or these sort of situations are inherently sort of ego. Ego is in there because you're wanting to present your work in its best possible light. You're possibly wanting to encourage people to buy your book or look into the other types of maybe offerings you have in the world. So I'm kind of feeling that tension this morning of the ego coming in, wanting to present my work to you and your listeners in the best possible light, but also wanting to stay open and vulnerable and knowing that who knows where the twists and turns may happen. I think that'll probably be part of a more interesting conversation.
Yes. Well, and thanks so much for speaking to that. I always try to approach these with as little agenda as possible, with openness, willingness to go with the flow, see where curiosity takes us. And I actually find that when people are too caught up in like thinking about how they're coming across or how they're going to present or kind of telling reciting the monologue that maybe they've prepared and recited many times, it really interrupts that creative flow, like the collaborative flow. I mean, you're walking a balance because, yeah, you are a professional and you teach at Pacifica, and so you have a kind of professional reputation and all of that. So how to be natural and related and still professional, I don't know. I'm so unconcerned with professionality, and I kind of rail against it. You know, my inner rebel comes out and just probably says things to defeat the ego's desire to come across as more refined and professional all the time. So I just allow it and go with it.
I think we need more of that. You know, when I found myself, and I'm sure some of your other guests have as well, thinking about, this will be something great to put on my website, or this will be something to link to social media. And I think maybe that's a place to start too, with the role of the artist today, the challenges that makers and creators have, is that in this modern Western world where social media is so prevalent and necessary to a certain degree, we can find ourselves preparing for that, thinking steps ahead of how something will show up on Instagram. What will this do when I, how many likes, how many potential followers, just all of those things. And I'm not a big user of social media, but I see those pressures in my students and the private clients that I have. I see them in myself.
Mm-hmm. Well, and before we started recording, we were talking about, you know, I was commenting on the lovely background that you've prepared, because we do think we're going to be on video, it's going to be recorded. So how do I appear, but what does my room that I'm in say about me? What does it communicate? And so we were talking about how you've been revising it recently, paring things down. And so that's even interesting, because you've made some very intentional decisions on what to leave and what to take away.
Yes, I have. And I totally realized that it's curated, as all of our, you know, Zoom backgrounds, for those of us who spend a lot of time on Zoom, are, if we take care. And for those of us who are creative individuals, that is something that's enjoyable. It reflects who we are. There's, I'll give you a tour. My right and my left. Here we have Jung's black books in their beautiful boxed set. What you're not seeing is that they're all shoved back in there with lots of little sticky notes on them from my explorations, but they still fit back in there. And then something alive and beautiful here, these orchids. The piece behind me is a triptych, a collaged and assemblaged piece. I call a construction, a type of multifaceted, multimedia piece involving drawing, collage, some added found elements. It's quite large. It's maybe about 9 feet long, 6 feet tall. There's silver leaf. There's two images that you may be picking up. The one up here is like a skull with issuing out two streams. That's called Mikitsli in Mesoamerican mythology. And this here, these are the two streams. And the top is fire. The bottom is water. And you can kind of see that fiery, jagged part in the bottom water. Mm. And that is called Atalachinoli. Not the easiest thing to say, but it is so profound. You know, when we think about philosophies of existence and depth psychological philosophies that involve a lot of polarities, this is, you know, hundreds of years before Jung, of this union of opposites, the polarities that are always joined. One way that it is translated is as burning water, that beautiful paradox of burning water, always joined together. very Heraclitean too.
Mm-hmm. Love and strife.
The tension, the cosmos works by harmony of tensions, like the bow and the lyre, the yin and yang.
Yeah. Recently, I don't know if you know his work, but James Maffey, he's an American scholar of Aztec metaphysics and philosophy. And we're talking about this element of polarities and balancing and walking that fine line, like holding the tension of the opposites. And I was asking him, is there like a singular kind of image like the yin-yang in the Aztec tradition? And he thought about it, and he thought of these masks that show both kind of life and death on the same face, which, yeah, that's one polarity. But this is, this is kind of like that yin-yang that I was searching for or wondering about. So that's beautiful. Thanks for bringing it in.
Yeah, you're welcome. I'm not a person that has tattoos yet, but I've always
never say never.
Never say never. If I was going to have one, and maybe I will for a birthday coming up, that's what I would have. And just to finish out here with the background, lots of books, piles of books. There's plenty more that aren't even showing. And this wonderful skull, this articulating. It's a skeleton, not just the skull.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The skeleton with the ability to articulate it, probably a medical model, but I think it's wonderful for, as a reminder, particularly on like long Zoom meetings, not this sort of meeting, but like work sort of academic faculties sort of meetings. Don't tell, of course, but it's good to have a reminder of, okay, this is what is important.
Yeah, I've always got I've got skulls all over my body too, but I always got a skull close by that when I'm doing client calls or Zoom calls, I can just glance over and go, okay, this is where it ends.
Mm-hmm. There's nothing like that for a good check-in of what matters.
Yeah, I'm curious. Why the black books and not the red book? You would think, you know, the red book being Jung's kind of magnum opus, is, full of his art and images. So why the black books, which are so text heavy, rather than the red book?
A space. It's just a curatorial decision. The red book, absolutely, is in another room. Hillman's beautifully blue spined volumes of his uniform edition is in the other room. So these are something to, I think, pare back a little bit rather than bringing it all in this one space.
I'm wondering if you have a Mesoamerican background in your lineage.
I probably do, although I can't trace back much further than my grandparents. I am a Latina. My mother is Mexican, born in Mexico. My father was American, died when I was only 7. So my mom was not a citizen at that time. We were living in a small town in Arizona where I grew up. And she stayed there with my sister and myself and worked toward becoming a U.S. citizen so that we could have opportunities that she didn't have. So she was born on a farm somewhere in the state of Sonora in Mexico when there weren't, like birth certificates. So it was, you were born at home, and she was one of 7. I think there are 3 of them still alive now, including my mom. So yes, at some place in time, my ancestry includes, I'm sure, the colonizers and the Spanish conquistadors, as well as the indigenous peoples of Mexico.
Hmm. Yeah, I was thinking about like what you've chosen for the background, and so they're the Mesoamerican elements. Jung is there. There's a tree. And I was thinking about James Hillman's notion that we should all try to discover whose tree we're on, like who's like our spiritual ancestors.
Yeah, I believe he called that our philosophical family tree. And of course, they don't have to be philosophers. But that is an exercise I actually do with my students, and they love it, is to who are your creative ancestors? And let's make our, I'd still call it a philosophical family tree. And the results are amazing. They can use collage. You don't have to be a highly trained artist to do that. You can pull images from the internet. Whose influence do you carry that you rarely think about? Or who do you think about a lot? Who's close to the roots of that tree? You know, Hillman had Heraclitus and Plato and Plotinus, and then the Neoplatonists, and moving up to, of course, Jung and those closer to our time. But it's an incredible exercise for one to do.
Yeah, it's something I have some of my clients do as well, like especially the creative types or people who are exploring depth psychology. One of the ways I think it's helpful is that it helps you narrow in your focus of study to those people who really resonate with you. Like when you read their words, there's that feeling that you're reading something true, or that someone's put to words something that you've only felt in a kind of pre-verbal way. That's how I kind of help people pick out who's on their tree. And then so it narrows your focus on those writers who really speak to your soul. But then it also, leads you down to the roots. Because if you get into Hillman, well, you're going to get into Jung. If you get into Jung, you're maybe going to get into alchemy and maybe Nietzsche or Goethe or, you know, some of the people who are in Jung's roots. And you're going to go through the Bible and a whole course of study in that. And it's like, what's the word I'm searching for? Like kind of an education. It's a curriculum. In a way.
It is. And it can be lifelong.
Especially with these folks.
Folks, yes. It's like the Heraclitean soul. There is no end. As far as we can explore and discover, we never reach the end. And that is, I think, something also amazing and enlivening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it keeps you going.
It does. And I think that's
curiosity keeps you going, right?
Yes. Yeah. Especially thinking of all the elders that are still active in depth psychological circles, you know, teaching or doing workshops or traveling. And I'm thinking like people like Dennis Patrick Slattery and Christine Downing and some of those just iconic teachers that were my teachers. I feel that I was so lucky to have had exposure to them, to have had them convey their wisdom and insights and be part of that. It's a lineage.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to ask you a little bit about your background. Like, I'm always curious for people who are, you know, like people on my tree or on your tree too. There's a lot of kind of overlap there. So I'm always curious, like, how did you get into Jung and Hillman and depth psychology?
I think through a fairly common route, a kind of my gateway drug, if I could put it in that term, is Campbell, Joseph Campbell.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Looking for inspiration for my work, you know, going through bookstores when there were a lot of bookstores around back in the day, where you could go into a Barnes and Nobles or somewhere and just go to mythology section. Something would catch your eye. I remember pulling out a book of his, I think it was called Mythic Images, because the images just spoke to me, particularly the Mesoamerican images. And I think that was my, the entry down that rabbit hole of Campbell. And you can't get too far with Campbell before encountering Jung and Nietzsche. And before you knew it, I was collecting my own little library. I was solo doing my own curriculum of study of those thinkers and others that were intersecting, and the circles kept growing and growing. And my main preoccupation at that time, I'm talking in my 30s and 40s, was my own personal fine art, you know, very devoted to that at that time. So this was feeding my visual art and my my soul. And it was not until my early 50s that I felt a real urge to combine, to devote myself to also the scholarly aspect of who I am. I had always loved learning. I did very well in school throughout my youth, but there was a long gap of time where my learning was self-directed. And I came to a point where I didn't feel I could go any further or to the places I wanted to go without guides, without working with mentors, without having peers, a group of other seekers and people whose family trees were similar. I didn't know them in my, well, I knew some, yes, I shouldn't say that. But yeah, I wanted to be part of a lineage, a tradition, to enter into something that felt like a mystery school.
So did you go to Pacifica to pursue that? Like, did you already have a BA in fine art or something and then go to Pacifica late in life?
That is what happened, yes. I had a BFA back in the last millennium. I won't tell you when. And then at 50, at 5-0, I decided to start graduate school and began working on an MA in mythological studies at Pacifica. At that time, which was about 15 years ago, the school did not have the program that I now chair, which is a program devoted to the creative individual. It's a 2 years, two-year master's program. So I found the closest resonance with the mythological studies program, which is still alive and doing beautiful work. It's a wonderful program, very much aligned with what I do in my program. And that is where I began another chapter of my life.
Yeah, well, so after the MA, I mean, you've got your PhD. So you also did that at Pacifica.
I did. Yeah, I continued there. I couldn't think of another place where I went to.
I know. It's the only place. If I was going to go anywhere to post-secondary education, it would have to be Pacifica. They're the only people that get me.
It is still that place. So I did follow through with a PhD. And then as synchronicity and luck and a little bit of self-assertion would happen, this combination of all three, I got to know Dr. Susan Rowland, who I know has been one of your guests in the past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And sent her a CV, met her, told her about myself, that I was curious about her program, which is the one I chair now. And she offered me a co-teaching position with her a year in the future. So, you know, time moved on. That opportunity came around. That was 2017. I began co-teaching with her, and we were instantly very compatible collaborators. And I count her as one of my chief mentors. She has been a tremendous guide for me in so many ways. So we chaired the program together for a few years. And now that Susan is so busy with her mystery writing, I mean, she's cranking out those murders left and right. It's incredible that she can now turn more of her attention to her creative callings. I've taken on more of the program chair roles and have been the sole chair for about 2.5 years now, where Susan still teaches in the program. She also teaches in our Jungian and Archetypal Studies program. So that, that's kind of the story to where I'm at right now with guiding this program, getting to teach such amazing people from diverse backgrounds, genders, ages, different countries, and also balancing that with my own urges and needs and desires and dissatisfactions around my own making.
I think it's really great that you're so well established as an artist first. It's not like, maybe somebody who, became a Jungian analyst and started doing collage as a kind of imaginal exercise or something like that. But the art was first. And also really inspiring to me that you really went on a new journey in the second half of your life. So I'm turning 50 this year, and I don't have a BA, so I can't get into Pacifica unless they pull some strings or something. But I have this fantasy of going there and finding, like, immersing myself in a community where people are speaking the same language and have the same interests. That is just, it's one of the things I long for in myself. So I can totally understand making a move like that.
Yes, and I think at its very best, it is just that. There are moments and parts of days when our students are on campus that just feel absolutely transcendent, magical, as if we were walking around the groves of, ancient Greece and talking about the most important ideas that affect human life and the cosmos. But there's an interesting story of getting a BA, someone wanting that to get into Pacifica so badly. Last year at our commencement, our guest speaker was a woman who had recently been elected as a California Supreme Court justice who had received her PhD at Pacifica. And one of the stories she told from the lectern to the assembled soon-to-be graduates and their guests was how she didn't have a BA. She was a very busy attorney, and she went to night school and studied on the weekends. And I think she must have started in her 40s or 50s, because I think she's comparable in age to myself, mid 60s now. But that was really inspiring to see her devotion to getting over that bar that is the gate to get into graduate study.
Yeah, I mean, I've come this close to entering into an undergrad course of study. Of course, I think, well, I would go and be like a psych major or something. And then I look at those first year courses that are required in a psych major degree, and I go, oh, there's no way. As soon as I'd encountered like a stats class or something, that would be the end of me. So my new thinking is, if I ever do it, I would have to go through music or something like that. Like, I'd have to go finally get my music degree that I dropped out of when I was 19, finish that up. And then that would be my way to get into a place like Pacifica.
Yes. That would be it. That would be perfect. And I would lobby for you to come join my program, and would be amazing.
Well, I got to tell you, so I'm doing the math in my head, and you're like around 65. And I mean, you're very youthful looking. And what's your secret? Is it just genetics? Is it those Latin genes? Or is there something about the creative life?
Sunscreen, I would say, truly. No, yeah. Sunscreen in your 20s will make your skin look great in your 60s. So it's never too late to start, for not just for women, people of all genders. Definitely that is big. occasional, you know, red wine here and there, some dancing, creative work, scholarly pursuits, all of that, yeah, comes together, I think.
Mm. Yeah, I think all of that would just lend itself to an inner glow that would maybe help to soften any signs of aging.
Yeah, I think we're on track.
Spark here. Of life, you know?
No, we have a new business venture here. We're sort of pondering. This is how it starts, you know? And, you know, by a year from now, we'll be marketing some, like, alchemical potion. We'll have beautiful bottles, and we'll be selling that.
Yeah. The creative life as a solution to aging. Or I mean, there's something to it, well, but there shouldn't be the only reason.
There is absolutely something to it. That's why there's so many elders, creative elders, that they don't retire. That it's not a word that they relate to. They're just so devoted and so enlivened by their work that they keep doing it.
Yeah. I mean, if anything, just retiring from the day job so you could fully devote yourself to the creative work at that stage in your life where you have less responsibilities and things, right?
Yes, that's a wonderful threshold, because a lot of those pressures of the outside world kind of fall away. And I've read some interesting interviews with quote unquote elder artists, senior artists who have found that to be this third or fourth act of their life, just so enriching. They're not ready to step into the shadows. They're not out, you know, golfing or at the casinos, or not that there's anything bad with, you know, everything in its place, but they are fully engaged with their calling, and many of them to have the time and energy to share what they know with others. They're volunteering at schools. They are hosting workshops. They're doing things in quiet ways that may never be known, but that are making a big difference.
Yeah, that's really interesting. This overlap of the role of the elder and the artist. I pulled this quote from your book, which I didn't mention yet, but you've written this really wonderful book, The Archetypal Artist, Reimagining Creativity and the Call to Create. And I was struck, you know, seeing the background behind you now and that big piece, you talk about how this book is a kind of bricolage. And so I'm, oh, of course, she's going to put together a book in the same way that she puts together her art, is taking these pieces and assembling them like an assemblage. So I pulled this quote, and I think it relates to what you're talking about in terms of the role of the artist, but also the role of the elder. You write, "The opus of the artist, witch, magician, and alchemist, is not directed toward a personal goal, nor is it an attempt to transcend the world. Instead, it is aimed at fostering a mutual relationship of creativity in and with the soul as the crossroads of multiple realities, both seen and unseen." So there's something in that about this last stage of life, being close to death, being you know, closer to the unseen world, maybe having less outer responsibilities, focusing more on the inner life and the spiritual life and preparing for death. So it seems like the perfect time to flourish as an artist is in that second half of life and beyond.
Yeah, I think that the idea of the closeness to death is also something that I'm now making connections to. Hillman's ideas of the nature of the soul, that it has a close relationship with death, that it is very much connected to love as well, to Eros. But it's a time, I think, if we can make it to that time, and not everyone can, and not everyone can set the majority of their worldly responsibilities aside. But if you can, even for moments, even for certain parts of days or weeks. You can open yourself up in ways that just aren't possible with a little chunk of time here, a little chunk of time there, with the responsibilities of life. And that should be where we're at as human beings, as we get into that elder phase, doing a lot of reflection, but not so much self-reflection that it's, you know, solipsism. It's preparing for whatever might be next, and offering the gifts we have to the next generations.
Mm. Yeah, you also talk about the thread that connects the shamanic archetype with the artist. One of those things being a call to service. It's what unites image makers and storytellers. And so again, it contradicts maybe the kind of Anglo-North American idea of elder as, okay, now it's time for me to retreat from the world and any sense of responsibility, and just focus on myself and have the golden years of acting like a teenager again and getting to do all those things that I had to put aside for so many years while I raised a family and sacrificed myself to work and all that kind of thing. But it's like this new call into service as something. I mean, what is the service that we can offer as we become less kind of culturally relevant in this particular culture? What can the elder person, the elder artist, or the artist in general offer our society or culture?
You know who I'm thinking of when you're asking that question is Michael Mead, someone that you may have interviewed in the past, who does so much work with elderhood in that transition, as does James Hollis, the very well-known, well-read, meaning his books are very popular and well-read. Jungian analyst. I think that offering may sound sort of common sense or cliche, but it's the wisdom that has been accrued, the discernment to say this matters, this doesn't matter. If you were giving advice to someone younger, don't waste your time on so much of that. That's not going to matter when you get to be my age, if you do. To stay true, to find ways to continually, or as often as possible, have a touchstone, a way of returning to yourself, a renewal process, so that you don't get swept away in a superficial life of making and spending.
Mm-hmm. Or yeah, just consuming and spending.
Consuming and spending.
Making, maybe.
Yeah, making, you know,
making money. Spending. Making money to just consume and then, yeah, yeah.
Yes, okay. That's the making I was referring to.
And that's a kind of encouragement to stick with what matters. And I think then the elder who is continually renewed and revivified by their creative life, their soulful life, becomes a model for maybe a different way to age. I mean, I can look at people who I consider mentors and elders. And one of the things that always strikes me is their ability to balance both the Senex and the Puer qualities late in life. So there's a youthful spirit that's very much alive and, like I was saying, kind of radiates through the aging body in a way that helps them still appear youthful and gives them an energy to keep doing the work, whatever that is. But it's grounded in the Senex quality of understanding limitations, reckoning with death, having some sort of discipline and consistency, that kind of thing is really common in the kind of people that I look to as role models.
Yes, I couldn't agree more for that sort of effervescence in a person that is also equally capable of gravitas at the same time. There's this playfulness of the two qualities.
I mean, Susan Roland seemed to have that to me as well. I could see how she could be an intimidating person because of her intellect and her kind of strength of character. But there is a sense of humor underlying it and a kind of effervescence that comes out at times. And so you get both, which I just find like kind of surprising and refreshing when you get to experience it and see the shifts. Like, this is not a one-sided person, you know?
Yeah, not at all. She's a great example. And I'm actually her elder, by the way.
Really?
Yeah, Susan's a couple of years younger than I am. But I was just telling a new student who's studying with her for the first time this spring that the student should be prepared to have a lot of fun. That not only is Susan a world-renowned Jungian scholar, but she's a whole lot of fun. She can be just wickedly funny.
Let's talk a little bit about this shamanic archetype or shamanic personality that runs through your book. You know, it's something I'm certainly interested in and is very central to me. I'm actually giving an experiential workshop on the weekend based around the shamanic personality or shamanic archetype. I mean, what about that captures your imagination? When did you become interested in shamanism or the shamanic archetype? Just to maybe start there, like, what's your interest in that? How did it come about?
Yeah, well, first I want to point out that I'm liking how you're framing it as a shamanic personality or an archetype. I like to use terms like shamanic sensibility, shamanic spirit, so that I'm wanting to parallel this archetypal life way with the life way, the archetypal patterning of the artist and creator. And there are many, many parallels. I think I started to pick up on those in my early readings with Campbell, you know, who will lead you eventually or sooner than later to Eliade and his very influential work on shamans and shamanism. But one thing that I want to do in this book, or wanted to do, and I'm not sure that I did it well enough, but I try to when I speak about it, is to make a real clear delineation between the archetypal patterning of the shamanic and the shaman per se, the actual medicine person who lives and works today in many places. So I don't want to appropriate. I don't want to go so far as to say artist equals shaman, or that one should, it's easy to be inflated, to get into an inflation, to also appropriate. Mm-hmm. But with those guardrails and cautions in mind, I want to honor the calling of the medicine person, whether they call themselves shamans or other things. And the calling and the patterning of the maker creator. And of course, there can be people who transcend both, who are a type of healer that is more
slash artist.
Yeah, to the shaman. And is also living and working, creating in a way that would be recognized as an artist. But I think the distinction is very important.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, even the word shaman to describe anyone who's indigenous or mestizo, who is working in healing. I mean, it's an anthropological term. It's, you know, it's whatever. It's a European appropriation of a
yes,
Siberian language group, all of that stuff. We need to talk about it. And so we need language. And so I like the distinction that you're drawing, that the word shaman describes someone is playing a functional role in a society or community. But there is something else that we can describe as or note as the shamanic archetype. I'd love to hear what you think that, the shamanic personality or sensibility, as you put it, what does that describe? Like, can you kind of help us feel into the qualities of the archetype?
Yes. That describes a person who has either submitted themselves or who have found themselves in a kind of initiatory process, either seeking that out or perhaps it by chance occurs to that person. It can happen through illness. It can happen through a significant loss. It can happen through, I love the phrase, a creative illness that you may have come across in my book. And I take that from Henri Ellenberger, who wrote a very definitive study on the origins of what we now call depth psychology. And he drew some very interesting parallels between the literal shaman, if we want to continue using that word, the traditional healer, and the analyst and the therapist. And along with that, one can find the same parallels to the artist and maker. Again, that sort of submission to an initiation into a way of life that includes where service to the soul is foremost, where some, either through training or through a revelatory experience, or maybe a combination of both, the person has discovered the ability to move through realities from this common reality that we in the West think is the only reality to traverse worlds. That's rather fundamental. And whether that's happening as an ecstatic sort of journey that we think about with the shaman healer, or as being a co-creator with the creative spirit. Many artists will describe their creative process in such a way, from this, and it seems to be on a spectrum, from maybe a very equal partnership in this dance with the creative, something else that is wanting to create with you, through you, to the other side of the spectrum is something that's more like a possession, where you are the servant, the vessel, the medium, the channel. You are taken over, similar to the very old Platonic idea of theomania, divine mania, of having the gods, the outside creative forces working through you when you are their servant. So those are some of the parallels as well, of being in communication with forces that in our regular daytime world, most people do not come in contact with. And you have the training, the ability, the courage to encounter those forces, both benevolent and malevolent. And your purpose is one of service to the collective.
I had this little red flag go up when you were talking about that correlation between the therapist and the shaman. Just because it seems like such a danger zone for grandiose inflation. What do you think it is that's so attractive about the shamanic archetype that can lead people to become, over-identified with it, inflated? Is it like a kind of romantic vision of the healer, the magician? Is it the power combination of both? Anything else?
It's absolutely the romanticism, the exoticism, the power trip, the ego inflation that can make that connection dangerous. But I think at the heart of it, the therapeutes, the original Greek term was a servant at the temple, a servant of the soul. In its best sense, and we know that Hillman found plenty to argue with about psychology, psychotherapy, analysis. In its best sense, it is serving the soul, but the soul has pretty much been drained out of, especially mainstream therapies. They don't speak much about the soul, but it's this service to soul, to the lost soul, to the hurting soul, to the world soul, that I think is the connecting thread, if it is held with humility and that we don't take on trappings that actually do the opposite of serving soul.
I'm trying to remember his name. He was an indigenous wise man from the U.S. I think it's Frank Old Crow, but he had a concept. Well, for him, it wasn't a concept, but it was how he saw his role. Where the Westerner might think of him as a medicine man or shaman. He said, my role is to be a hollow bone for spirit to move through. Mm-hmm. And I really like that because it requires like an emptying out of one's self, one's, own intentions, agendas, all of that stuff. And there's also the element of like a hollow bone was the first musical instrument that we've found. You know, it's these hollow bones with little holes pierced in them to be the first flute. So I think about that as like the spirit moving through you as an instrument for something beautiful. I'm going to identify with that. It seems like that's the kind of attitude I want to bring to any kind of work I do in the imaginal or healing world.
Yes. And I want to bring that same sensibility. I mean, it's so, it can be so inspiring without being inflating. I mean, it's stirring, it's soul stirring just to hear you say that. It's thrilling. And there are a few places in the book that I caution against flying off with that into a giant inflation. Because it comes, on one hand, it is all of those things. But on the other hand, it comes with tremendous responsibility. It's a devotion to a way of being that is continually working on diminishing the ego. There's a person that I spend a few pages on in the book, a little known Jungian analyst from the 20th century and writer and theorist, Rosemary Gordon, who was part of that sort of second generation of Jungians. And here's one of those chance things that someone loosely associated with Pacifica, in a passing conversation when I was telling them about my interest, said, oh, you should really look at her book, Rosemary Gordon's book, Dying and Creating. And that title just stayed with me. I don't know if I wrote it down or I just remembered it. I tracked down that book at some point. And that is a wonderful window into what we're talking about here, the correlations between the creative person suffering ego deaths, much like the healer. Mm-hmm. Being willing to submit oneself to that, which especially in our Western culture now is abhorrent. We're such a culture that is focused on control that the idea of surrender seems frightening. It is frightening, but it seems like something that should not even be attempted.
In order to fully surrender, you have to trust nature, the world, spirit. You have to trust something other than yourself. Like, you know, Jung's amazing question. What supports you when you no longer support yourself? Like, what a question to wrestle with for a modern person. You know, is there anything that you can count on beyond yourself?
Well, and circling back,
I mean, you have to be in contact with that in order to give yourself over to it, right?
Yes, you have to at least believe it exists and not be stuck in rationality, not be stuck in ideas about reality, about human willpower.
Upholding the ego or the persona. You can't be too caught up in that either, because you got to be willing to be humiliated, or, you know, like, I like that word humiliated. I mean, it's got earth in it. It's got humus in it. And yeah,
it does. You need to be.
What a radical idea. Like, to be humiliated in our culture is like one of the worst things.
It's the worst thing. It is the worst thing to be humiliated. And this, we're still talking about these parallel processes, these life waves, these archetypal patterns. It's not only humiliation, it's dismemberment. You know, when you start talking alchemy as well.
And these dissolving.
Yes, dissolving, all of the operations, breaking down into the, going into the negredo, which could be a correlate to this creative illness, which could be months or years in that soupy mess. Before something starts to congeal again, coagulate again. And most people will not endure that, not for long. But I think the shaman, another word that I've come across is the intercessor, which I like, which Patsy Hawkwing is a Lakota healer who wrote a beautiful chapter in a book called the Parallels Between Analytical Psychology and Shamanism, a book that's maybe 20 years old or so now. Mostly the essays are by analysts. I think she's the only essay in there, the only essay of an indigenous person who is a healer in the type, in the model we would call a shaman, but she calls herself an intercessor.
So intercessor, meaning one who, like a hermetic character, one who helps communication between the spirits and the person, or the gods and the person, that kind of thing.
Yeah, the psychopomp associated with Hermes. That is another model that transcends both the traditional healing path and the path of the artist's creator. You are a guide of souls. You're moving between realities. You are coming back with something. And this gets into a little bit of the Campbellian, you know, hero's journey, returning with a boon. But if you take the heroic out and put the humility in, I think that's what we're talking about.
Yeah, certainly there would be the element of the descent, the need to be mentored into that role or that capacity. But returning, you know, unlike the kind of heroic archetype, not returning just with some piece of your own soul or something for yourself or your own gifts to bring to the world, but helping to bring, I don't know. See, here we get it. Kind of tricky for me, because there is an idea in kind of neo-shamanic circles that we as shamanic practitioners can do soul retrievals for other people. and kind of take on that role of the shaman healer. I'm not very comfortable with that. I think when I do the kind of soul journeying with people, my role is to facilitate people going on their own descent to discover what parts of them need to be retrieved, recovered, tended to, accepted, loved. I don't want the responsibility of trying to diagnose for someone where their soul loss is. I really believe that people are able to do that themselves. And so for me, that's part of like awakening up the shamanic sensibility within ourselves.
Yes, I think those cautions are very important, to not take that on, but to guide in ways that are appropriate for us as contemporary Western people who did not grow up, who were not embedded in a kind of cosmos where these multiple realities, the idea of a soul retrieval was thought possible, where you had elders that could train you. So that's another place of real caution. But I think something that the creative person can do, as we're continuing down these parallel tracks, through their work, they can reveal what they've discovered in the thing that they make. They can share an experience in a kind of reality, an experience of perhaps what is coming, a kind of prophetic experience with their communities. So it's this, I've come back with something, I've had an experience. It wasn't just for me. I'm going to make and shape something, a song, a dance, a novel, a film that will allow you to participate in that. And it just may transform you. It may give you something, the medicine. We can use that word, and artists also use that word, not just healers. The medicine that you're looking for, or it can shift you in a way that you begin to shift the world around you. So this enhanced consciousness is a magic ability, an ability of artists to enhance consciousness and to enhance compassion.
That's interesting. Enhance consciousness. One of the definitions of magic that you come across is someone who's able to transform or manipulate consciousness. You know, in the old days, they would say manipulate reality. But, you know, someone like Dion Fortune kind of revised that for moderns. It's like, well, you have the ability to transform your consciousness. That seems to come from an egoic place. Like, who's the one in me that knows how my consciousness needs to be transformed? I don't know. But I do like the idea of enhancing consciousness in terms of becoming more aware of the different parts of oneself, becoming more aware or interested in the world as, you know, a community of beings. I mean, there's so many people out there, not merely human people. And there's something about that enhances your life. Yeah. But so I like that, enhancing consciousness.
Enhancing. And I don't think it's an ego driven thing in the way that I'm, trying to get across. Mm-hmm.
No, I was referring to the idea of changing my consciousness.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, not that. It's more akin to Jung's idea of bringing things to light, bringing more of the unconscious, and that's a whole nother term.
Bringing. Can I just revise that? Bringing light to things.
Yeah, bringing light to things, or bringing, it doesn't even have to be light. We don't have to use that.
Right. Awareness.
Bringing our attention to So we are enhanced. We are enlarged. We are made more complex, more caring, more prone to notice things that we don't notice now. Mm.
And if we start noticing things that we don't notice now, like the world out there, we're going to see that it has value. And then maybe we'll think it's worth preserving or tending to and caring for. And so this, you know, this comes to another quote that I really love. And this is from Susan Rowland. And this speaks to something I think about a lot in terms of, you know, how does my modern mind coexist with what I think of as my mythic mind or, you know, my ancestral mind, the mind that knows dreams are real, that, you know, that sees synchronicities everywhere, that sees that tree as an alive, sentient being, you know, how do they coexist? And so I think of them like being bridged in a way. So I shift from one kind of form of consciousness to another, depending on the situation. I don't know if eventually, you know, those sides of ourselves will meld. I think it's really important for people to reclaim the mythic or ancestral mind, which I think is related to art and this shamanic archetype. But I like how Susan put it here. And so you kind of, you paraphrase her in a way. So this is your quote, but referring to something that she talks about. This is from your book, A Renewal of Witch Consciousness, W-I-T-C-H, a renewal of witch consciousness with its respect for multiple realities, including the sacred and the sciences, mythos and logos, is a necessity for the 21st century. And it seems that that's what you're talking about here is we need to reawaken that capacity in order to avoid, you know, human extinction, extinction of the planet, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes, precisely. And another way of describing what you've just read there is the idea of transdisciplinarity, which may have come up in your conversation with Susan. Yeah. It's a key part of her work and something I see her infusing in the many arenas where she works. And that is just this radical centering of what we think of as the current hierarchy of ways of knowing, of making knowledge, and of allowing all those things that we have pushed aside for centuries that have been grouped under this umbrella that we might call the feminine, things like the occult, the sacred, the non-rational, the animal world,
intuition,
imagination, everything that we have pushed aside in modernity is exactly what we need right now to turn back to. Because as we've seen, rational arguments aren't enough to convince our communities, our friends, neighbors, of the real dangers, the perils that we're facing.
That's right. Yeah, because scientists have been talking since at least the 1950s about the, you know, the imminent, you know, collapse of the oil industry or the heating of the planet, you know. When I was growing up in the 80s, it was like greenhouse gases and aerosol cans and the hole in the ozone. So, you know, people have been kind of sounding that alarm for a long time from a rational perspective. If we continue to do this, this is inevitable. But it hasn't been enough, obviously, to create major change. So, yeah, I think you're right. Something else needs to be awakened.
Not enough. There's a quote near the end of the book from Lawrence Ferlinghetti, the late poet and publisher,
City Lights Bookstore,
who just died within the last couple of years, who said something like, that the purpose of art is transformation of the world. Anything less than that is unacceptable. And that's a provocative statement. I mean, that's a sobering and inspiring statement for anyone who makes things, for an artist, to think about that you actually have powers. That is another key theme, a thread that I hope comes through this book, to ennoble creators, makers, artists, to view themselves as people possessing vital powers for our world now.
If you enjoyed this preview and want to hear the full episode and gain exclusive access to the first 100 episode archive, head on over to patreon.com/howl in the wilderness and join the pack. Thanks for listening.